Well, folks, I see by the calendar that next Saturday is April 1st. And I'm wondering how many youngsters will be out playing pranks the way we used to on the first day of April. Do the kids of today ever hide behind fences waiting for old ladies to tug at pocketbooks nailed to sidewalks? And do dignified gents ever have a chance to kick at a hat with a brick in it? And does anyone ever leave a message for the boss to call up Mr. Fish or Miss Fox at the aquarium or Franklin Park Zoo? Boy, that was hot stuff 20 years ago. And when I was a youngster, a little before that, it was common practice for sportsmen to telephone some friend and ask, "Say, do you want a nice mess of trout for breakfast?" And when the friend said, "Sure, thanks," the jokester would say, "All right, hold the line." Then he'd hang up and let him wait. Yes, sirree, that was fooling him. You know, I don't believe any lad working in the shipyards or around the stone quarries ever got by without being sent from one end of the place to another after a bucket of steam, a left-handed monkey wrench, or a gallon of striped paint. I've heard it said that the granite cutters over on Vinyl Haven, Hurricane, Dix, and High Islands played unmerciful jokes on each other, probably because that was the only entertainment they had. Most of those jokes can't be described over the radio, but there's one classic prank that has always stuck in my memory. I heard about it when I went over to Hurricane Island to spend a week's vacation with my Uncle Charlie. The minute school closed in June, Bill Healy and I would hive for Hurricane. Bill's father was agent for the steamboat company, so we got free tickets, and my Uncle Charlie ran the boarding house. We had the whole great, grand, glorious adventure, free gratis for nothing. And what grub! Uncle Charlie was a born storyteller, and one of his best ones was about old John Gow, who worked for him one summer as a dishwasher. John was a simple-minded soul, and he believed anything anybody told him. He first appeared on the wharf at Hurricane as an escort to three cows, two pigs, and a crate of hens. It had been rough coming over from Rockland, and John was as green as a cucumber around the gills and scared to death just thinking about the trip back. Uncle Charlie knew this, and he used the poor man's fright of seasickness to get him to work in the kitchen as a dishwasher. When the job was first offered, John turned it down cold. But when Uncle Charlie told him the captain of the little steamboat was going back to Rockland by way of the West Indies to pick up a load of molasses, and the fare would be $175 and take 3 months, John capitulated. He put on a white apron and went to work. He got his meals, a tiny cubbyhole to sleep in up over the kitchen, and 85 cents a day. Now, in appearance, Mr. Gow looked not unlike Chick Sale. He had a huge, wind-blown, fuller-brush moustache, a little button of a nose, and pale blue eyes that popped right out on his cheeks when he got excited, and that was pretty often. He got awful excited one night when he heard two of the foremen whispering under his window, "I tell you, Clint, if this is oil, we'll be millionaires. I wish there was some outside around here we could get to stake out the claims." John come right through the window, mosquito netting and all. Heard what you said about the oil," he said. "I'm an outsider, and I'll do anything. What do you want me to do?" And his moustache wagged up and down like a donkey's tail. "Is there really and truly oil on this island, real oil?" The foreman nodded. "Now, not so loud, John. We want to keep this a secret. Well, what'll we do? Let's drill. What can I do?" "Well," he said, "you be at the old quarry hole back of the schoolhouse tomorrow night around 7:30. And don't you tell a soul about this, understand?" All that night and the next day, John Gow dreamed what it would be like to be a millionaire. And after he'd washed the dishes and hung the towels to dry, he sneaked through the woods till he reached the big flat ledge that sloped down to the sea. And there in the semi-darkness, he found the foreman sniffing significantly of two slender sticks. Clint Reynolds said, "Cut a branch off that alder bush, John, and shove it in this test boring." And he jerked his thumb toward a hole drilled in the ledge years ago to hold the guy wire on a derrick. John cut off a branch and stripped off the leaves and stuck it in the hole, and glory be. When he pulled it out, it was dripping with a sticky, oily substance that smelled suspiciously of kerosene. John's old eyes bugged out so far he could look right inside his mouth. "It's oil," he said. "It's oil. We'll all be millionaires. Let's start digging right now." But the foreman said, "Oh, we can't do that, John. Not until we form a company. Now, each of us will put up $10. And next Friday, I'll take a sample of this over to the state laboratory and have it analyzed. If it's oily oil, we're rich. But we won't know until the chemist makes a test. And while I'm gone, John, I think it'd be a good idea for you to mark off that ledge. Make each claim about 10 feet square. I hope we'll be selling them pretty soon for $1,000 apiece." Well, they shook hands all around, and John handed over his $10. During his spare time for the next few days, John crawled over that big ledge with chalk and string, staking out claims, while the foremen were over in Rockland having a good time. When they got back to Hurricane, John Gow knew from the look on their faces that they'd brought bad news. "I'm sorry," Reynolds said, laying his hand on John's shoulder, "but the state lab says this isn't oily oil after all. It's just ocean oil, but soaked up through the granite. Better luck next time." "Yeah, well, what about my $10? "Oh, we had to spend all of that and our money besides getting that sample analyzed. But cheer up, old man. We're giving a party tonight and you're invited." Well, John went and he had a good time, never dreaming that the lusty liquid spike that went into the punch was purchased with his $10. On April's Fool's Day, they played all sorts of jokes on poor old John. They got him up before daybreak to see a sea serpent, then filled his bunk with chopped up horsehair. They gave him chocolate stuffed with cayenne pepper and put molasses in his boots. But he took it in good stride and just grinned. When the first warm days of June came and the men sat around after supper, John Gow was initiated into the painful mysteries of a snipe hunt. And on the following 4th of July, he almost met his Waterloo. It had been hot on Hurricane for several days, and the blazing sun and the southwest offshore breeze made the island fairly sizzle. In fact, some of the paving cutters fried eggs on the hot ledges, just as a gag. But it was no joke for John Gow, working in that stifling kitchen and trying to sleep in his airless cubbyhole up over the stoves. When he complained of being dizzy, one of the gang told him, "You ain't eating enough, John. You got to eat in order to sweat. Now, you see them drops of water on that pipe? Well, feel and see how cool it is. That pipe is full, so it sweats. And when you're full, you'll sweat, and you'll be just as cool." So John staggered into the steaming dining hall where 200 paving cutters jostled, jabbered, and bolted their heavy meals, and he sat down at the little table in the corner where the help was served. According to Uncle Charlie, John had 3 large helpings of corned beef and cabbage, 6 potatoes with turnip and onions, then a good-sized slab of fried tripe, and he finished up with a bucket of steamed clams and a pint of strawberry ice cream. And it wasn't too long afterward before he was sweating. The clams made him thirsty, so he downed a couple of bottles of home-brewed beer, and that did it. He went out like a light. The boys carried him out back at the bunkhouse and laid him down on a hot blanket. And when he wasn't any better by sundown, they all come forward with their favorite remedy. One fellow suggested they mix the medicine all together. So they did, and somehow they got it down John's gullet. Why it didn't kill him, the Lord only knows. Now, this was the day before the 4th of July, and being in holiday mood, the pranksters really went to town with old John Gow. They got Henry Scheibels, the carpenter, to make a box, just John's size, out of some pine boards, and they borrowed a fancy nightgown from the storekeeper. The gown had a lace collar and some ruffled sleeves, and after it had been pulled over John's clothes, he was placed in his new coffin and carried, unconscious, of course, into the church, where it was nice and cool and quiet. Some old paper lilies left over from the Easter pageant were piled round him, and some plumber's candles were lighted and set on the windowsill. Then one of the Italian boys came up and clipped off his mustache, and a couple of wires were rigged to keep him from falling out of the casket if he woke up sudden. Then came the crowning trick of all. A discarded slab of granite was taken to the shed where the air drills were, and the following epitaph was cut deep in the stone. John Gow, a good friend, gone but not forgotten. They set the slab in the only plot of green grass in sight down by the flagpole, and some wildflowers in tin cans were arranged around it. Well, old John came to about sunset. He didn't know where he was because he'd never been in the chapel before. And in that nightgown, and with the lilies and the candles, and himself in a casket, he got the general idea that maybe he was dead. But alive or dead, he wanted a drink of water, and he yelled for it. And old Angus MacDonald, the only man on the island who had long white whiskers, and was all wrapped up in a bedsheet waiting for him, he come forward and said in a hoarse whisper, "Welcome, Brother Gow, to the kingdom of heaven." And then, by prearrangement, several of the boys rushed over and sang, "Shall we gather at the river?" just outside the window. But they all got to laughing, and they had to leave before John discovered who they were. When he finally got loose and reached the dining hall, he found his chair draped in black and his kitchen cronies loudly lamenting his demise. He was a good man, John Gow was. What a shame he couldn't have seen the funeral we'd give him. Bet he'd been mighty proud of that handsome headstone. Yeah, and I'll bet he'd be tickled pink to think that we thought enough of him to bury him right down there by the flagpole. John didn't feel dead a bit. He was just hungry, and he had to see that headstone. So down he staggered, with the whole crowd peeking from behind convenient hiding places. At the flagpole, he sat down and stared incredulously at his headstone. John Gow, gone but not forgotten. Well, he said thoughtfully, I guess maybe I am dead and gone. And feeling that things had gone far enough, the boys rushed out. They shook him by the hand and pounded him on the back and picked him up and carried him round and round and hollered and shouted, John's come back from the grave, hooray, hooray. They gave him some hot coffee and brandy and lobster stew and donuts and cheese and pickles and mince pie, and in no time he was feeling pretty good. Uncle Charlie said that night the boys passed the hat and took up a sizable collection for the poor old fella on account of his being such a good sport. Well, today, Hurricane Island is completely deserted. All the houses have been torn down and even the wharf is gone. But in its heyday, it was a lively and colorful stone-cutting settlement. You know, sometime I'd like to go over to Hurricane Island and just poke around to see if John Gow's headstone is still standing where the flagpole used to be. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the old-time stonecutters remember it. Well, I guess there's no doubt about it, folks. The old-fashioned type of jokes were pretty rugged, especially around April Fool time.